Greg? He disappeared. A second later, they both appeared in the doorway. Look, he said, holding out a hand. I could tell that that gesture half killed him. We're mates, really. Like Kathleen said, the storm just made us a little cranky. Yeah, said Greg as he took the hand and shook it. Nothing to be frightened of. Sorry, love. She looked at me, then at her mother. Liza's smile seemed to reassure her. Really? We'll go now. Mike tried to raise a smile. I'm sorry, okay? Me too, said Greg. I'll be headed off now. And Liza, he said to her meaningfully, you know where I am. I could tell she wanted to say something, but the telephone started to ring. She strode past him into the hall to answer it. Kathleen, Hannah, Greg was deflated now. I'm real sorry. I wouldn't frighten you for the world, sweetie, you know that. I squeezed Hannah's shoulders, but she still didn't seem to want to respond. Suddenly, Liza was back in the room, her oilskin already half on. The argument was forgotten. That was Tom, she said, voice tight. He says there's ghost nets drifting into the bay.
18. Mike. The room was a blur of activity. I stood in the midst of it, my handkerchief pressed to my bloodied face, wanting to ask what a ghost net was, but it was as if they were marching to a drumbeat I couldn't hear. I'll come up with you, Kathleen was telling Liza, pulling on her gloves. I'll steer while you cut. Yoshi already had her jacket on. Has someone rung the Coast Guard? She was asking. Lance had a mobile phone pressed to his ear. Signal's down. You stay here, lovey, said Liza to Hannah. No, said Hannah, her previous fragility forgotten. I want to help. Liza's face was stern. No, you stay here. It's not safe. But I want to help. Then stay here, and when the lines are back up, field the calls. Ring the national parks, the whales and dolphins people, anyone you can think of. Get them to send out as many people as they can, okay? The numbers are in the book on the hall table. She knelt and looked her daughter straight in the eye. It's very important that you do that, Hannah. We're going to need as many people as possible. Hannah seemed mollified. Okay. Kathleen came back into the room, oilskin on, a large torch under her arm. I've put the wetsuits in the back of the car. Spare torch. Has everyone got cutters? Greg pulled his woolen hat low over his head. I've got a spare pair in my lockup. I'll run down and get them. Lance, give us a lift down. We'll be quicker. I looked at Liza, feeling as I had when I'd first come here. An outsider. Useless. What can I do? I said. I wanted to talk to her in private. To apologize for mine and Greg's stupidity, to find a way to be of some use, but she was already somewhere else. Stay here, she said, glancing at Hannah. Best that there's someone in the house, and don't let the dog out. How's the weather looking, Kathleen? She tucked her hair into her hat and peered outside. Been prettier, said Kathleen, but there's not a lot we can do about that. Okay, let's go. We'll keep in touch by radio. As they trooped out, Hannah explained that vast fishing nets, some many miles long, with floats at the top and weights at the bottom, had drifted into the bay. Labelled walls of death, they had been declared illegal in Australian waters, but as a result many had been dumped overboard or had torn away from their ship and floated along until, weighed down by the bodies of those sea creatures they had caught and killed, they sank to the seabed. We learnt about them at school, she said, but I never thought they'd come here. She bit her lip. I hope our dolphins will be okay. I'm sure your mum and the others will do everything they can to make sure they're fine, I said. Come on, haven't you got some calls to make? The lines were back up, the mobile signals restored. I made myself a cup of tea while I listened to Hannah leaving urgent messages on answer phones and occasionally talking to someone who might have been an authority. She was astonishingly poised, I thought, for an 11-year-old. Then again, I had never met an 11-year-old who knew as much about dolphins as she did. Outside, the thunder and lightning had moved on, but the rain beat down mercilessly, sending rivers down the panes and hammering an insistent tattoo on the flat roof of the porch. I put another couple of logs on the fire, then paced the kitchen, watching the dog's eyes flicker from me to the door and back again. "You get them?" I said, when Hannah came in.
"Most of them," she said. "I think the Coast Guard must be out already. I wish I was helping."
She peered out wistfully through the rain-spattered window. "You are. Someone has to make the calls."
"Not proper help. You're getting a bruise."
She pointed to the side of my face. "Serves me right," I grinned. Hannah reached out for the dog, who lifted her nose.
"I looked out of the window upstairs, and there are loads of boats in the bay with their lights on."
"There," I said. "I told you they'd be okay. Everyone's out helping." But she didn't seem to hear me. It was then that I heard a shrill sound from upstairs. My mobile phone. "Back in a sec," I said, and leapt up the stairs two at a time, wondering fleetingly if it was Liza. She might have tried to call while Hannah was on the telephone. But when I reached my room and scrabbled in my pocket, the little screen told a different story. I gazed at the name, at the flashing backlight, then flipped the button. "Hello?" There was a pause. "Vanessa?"
"Mike."
I looked out of the window at the dark night, just able through the rain to see the lights of the boats illuminating the inky black. I had no idea what to say.
"I heard you quit," she said.
She sounded as if she might be next door. I sat down on the leather chair.
"A week ago, I didn't work any notice."
It already felt another lifetime ago.
"I've been off," she said. "I didn't know. Dad didn't tell me."
"I would have called," I said, "but..."
"Yes."
There was a long silence.
"I didn't want to go in," she said. "Not with you and her still there."
I dropped my head into my palm and took a deep breath.
"I'm so sorry, Ness."
There was another silence. I felt the hurt in it, and was crushed.
"I wanted to tell you it was stupid and you deserve better, but you really should know that it was only once and I regretted it more than I can say, really."
More silence. I guess she was digesting this.
"Why did you quit?"
I frowned.
"What do you mean?" "Did Dad make you go? Because I never meant you to lose your job. I mean, I know I went against you at that meeting, but I just wanted to... I just felt so..."
"It wasn't your dad," I said. "It was my own decision. I thought it would be best, you know, given..." I was distracted by the sound of the dog barking. "In fact, he asked me to stay."
"I'm glad," she said. "It's been worrying me. Mike?"
"Hmm?" The dog sounded as if she was at the front door. I wondered if I should go down, but I knew that if she kept barking, I wouldn't hear a word Vanessa said, and it was important to me that we squared this. "Vanessa, I..."
"What's that noise?"
The dog was scrabbling at something now, whining. I stood up and went to my door. I wondered if one of the whale chasers was trying to get back in, but the door was rarely locked. "The dog,"
I said absently. You don't have a dog, she said.
Not my dog.
I held my hand over the phone. Hannah?
Where are you?
She said. I hesitated.
Mike?
I'm in Australia, I said. A stunned silence has a different quality from any other, I realized at that moment. It stretches, takes on greater weight, then implodes under the weight of unspoken questions.
Australia?
She said weakly. I had to come back, I said, craning over the banister now. I told you I thought this development was a mistake, Ness, and I'm here to try to put it right. I've got to go. There's things going on here, and I'm sorry, okay? I'm sorry for everything. I've got to go. I switched off my phone and ran downstairs. Millie was hurling herself at the front door, barking feverishly. Hannah, I said, sticking my head round the kitchen door, hoping she might tell me what was going on. But she was not in the kitchen or the living room. She was not in her bedroom or any of the other rooms upstairs. She was not by the phone in the hallway. I was still so disorientated by my conversation with Vanessa that it took me longer than it should have to grasp that neither was her jacket. I stared at the empty peg, then at the dog, who was still barking, glancing round at me as if I should be doing something. My heart sank. Oh, Christ, I said, and grabbed an oilskin jacket. Then I fumbled for the lead and attached it to Millie's collar. Okay, old girl, I said, opening the door. Show me where she's gone. The worst of the storm might have passed, but the rain still bore down in solid, unforgiving sheets, drowning sound, sending rivers over my feet as I splashed down the coast path after Millie. I didn't think I'd ever experienced rain like that before. It fell into my mouth as I shouted Hannah's name, had saturated my jeans and shoes within seconds. Only my upper half was dry, protected by the oilskin. Millie strained at the lead, her whole body a shining missile, hampered only by my own lack of speed on the unlit path. Steady, I shouted, but the word was carried away on the wind. I ran through the dark, trying to remember the location of the potholes, and saw trucks arriving by the jetty, their headlights blurred by the moisture in the air. In the bay, as I drew closer, I could see the lights of the boats, maybe 100 feet apart, bobbing as they struggled against the waves. I couldn't make out clearly what they were doing. Hannah! I yelled, knowing it was pointless. I prayed that Millie knew who she was looking for and that she wouldn't lead me to Liza. The dog skidded to a halt by some large sheds, the lock-ups where some of the whale chasers stored their gear. Several doors were open, as if the crews had been in too much of a hurry to get out onto the water to think about protecting their belongings, and Millie skidded into one, her paws scrabbling on the concrete floor. I hesitated in the sudden quiet, the wet lead slipping through my fingers, and tried to get my bearings. Hannah! I yelled. The rain thrummed dully on the flat roof and fell in ceaseless streams through cracks in the guttering. A low wattage bulb hung from the middle of the ceiling, and I could just make out a contour map of what looked like sea depths on the wall. There were various plastic canisters, wooden crates full of tools, and lined up against the opposite wall, ropes, buoys, and rolls of canvas. I could smell fuel. Hannah! I stared at the framed license on the wall. Greg Donahoe. This was Greg's lockup. In that brief moment of stillness, I remembered a snatched conversation I had once heard about a little boat that was out of bounds, a boat that lived in Greg's lockup. Oh, Christ, I said, into the too vacant space around me, and grabbed a torch as Millie, perhaps coming to the same conclusion, bolted for the waterfront. I ran, my fingers locked round the dog's lead, trying to fight rising panic as I drew close to the sea and saw the conditions that the boats were working in. Heavy waves crashed onto the beach, clawing and pounding at the shore. the bastard cousins of those I had jogged past happily on many bright mornings. Out in the bay, perhaps half a mile to sea, boats bobbed and engines whined, trying to maintain position, and now I heard voices, lifted briefly above the noise of the rain. I scanned the horizon, trying to wipe water from my eyes, and the dog strained at my legs. I had no idea where the child might be in that inky blackness, but I could see that even the experienced adult crews were struggling in that water. "Hannah!" I yelled. I ran towards the jetty, the thin beam of the torch scanning the ground in front of me. 100 feet back, I found 2 men pushing a small motorboat towards the water. Both were wearing life jackets. I could barely make out their faces. "I need your help," I gasped. "There's a child, a girl. I think she's gone out on the water."
"What?"
One of the men stepped forward, and I recognized him as a dog walker I had met during my previous stay.
"You're going to have to shout, mate. I can't hear you."
"A girl." I gestured towards the bay. "I think she might have taken a dinghy out by herself. She's only a kid." The 2 men looked at each other, then at the boat.
"Grab a jacket," one shouted.
I couldn't think where to leave the dog, so I shoved her in too and helped them push it out onto the water. "Hannah McCullen," I yelled as the engine roared into life. "Little girl from the hotel." The other gestured to me to point the torch out to sea. As I grabbed the side with my other hand, trying to hang on, he took his own light and hooked it onto the front of the boat, scanning the waves. If I hadn't been so concerned for Hannah's safety, I would have been afraid. I have always tended to avoid risky situations, and as the boat bounced off the waves, then hit them with a smack, jarring me, I would rather have been anywhere in the world than out on that sea.
"See anything?"
the man in the blue cap yelled. I shook my head. I was shivering now, which made it hard to keep Millie wedged safely between my legs. I tied her lead to the side rail. I had to focus on finding Hannah.
"Gotta watch out for the nets," one shouted. "If we get the propeller caught up, we're really stuck."
I worked out their plan. To start at the jetty end and do a sweep of the bay, taking in all of the boats we could see, making sure she was not among them. I sat braced against the side, stomach lurching as we negotiated the waves, my torch beam swinging out, showing nothing but the dark, churning waters beneath us. As we drew closer to the other boats, it seemed that half of Silver Bay had turned out in huge cruisers and little motorboats. I caught sight of bodies in wetsuits, others in oilskins handing down shears. They didn't notice us. They were focused on their own task and trying to keep their boat stable.
"It's a bugger of a size,"
yelled one of the men. I assumed he was talking about the net, but I couldn't see it. We ploughed on through the waves, up to the next boat. Hannah was not there. I wondered whether I'd got it wrong. Perhaps the little boat no longer lived in Greg's lockup. Perhaps she was still at home and I had misunderstood. But then I remembered Millie's reaction. Her face was tense and watchful, and I decided to trust her. I couldn't risk believing that Hannah was not out there. As we passed the 6th or 7th boat and headed for the mouth of the bay, I became aware of the ghost nets. We passed between one of the Mobys and another cruiser, and with the greater illumination their light shed, I glimpsed what looked like a tangled web just visible at the top of the floodlit waves. In it I could see unidentifiable shapes and struggled to work out what it was I was seeing. Then Millie barked, great anxious gulps, and I heard screaming. The dog sprang up, straining at her lead. I swung my torch and shouted to the men, "Cut the engine!" As it stalled, I could hear Hannah, a thin, terrified shriek. As the men started the engine and steered towards my pointing arm, I saw, briefly illuminated by my weak beam, a little boat rocking dangerously, a small figure clinging to its side.
"Hannah!"
I shouted, and the motorboat swung towards her, its engine almost drowned by the noise the dog was making.
"Hannah!"
The boat's light was on her then, and I could see her clearly, her face contorted with fear, her hands gripping the side, her hair plastered over her face as the rain beat down on her. "It's okay," I shouted, but I wasn't sure if she could hear.
"Help me,"
she was sobbing.
"The nets are all caught up in my rudder. I can't move."
"It's okay, sweetheart." I wiped rain out of my eyes. "We're coming." I turned as I felt the engine slow beneath me.
"Closer,"
I yelled to the men.
"We've got to get closer."
One swore loudly.
"I can't go any nearer," he yelled. "We'll get stuck in the nets ourselves. I'll radio the lifeboat."
"Can we throw her a rope?"
"If her rudder's caught in the nets, it won't help her."
Hannah's scream as a huge swell hit galvanized me.
"I'll get her,"
I shouted, kicking off my shoes.
"You're sure you'll be okay? What the hell else are we going to do?"
One man handed me a pair of cutters as I pulled off my jacket. The other was hauling the front of my life jacket together, securing the ties.
"Just watch you don't get caught in the nets yourself," he shouted. "I'll try to keep the light on you. Swim where I'm pointing it, okay? Follow the beam."
Even with the life jacket, the force and cold of the sea struck me like a blow. I gasped as another wave crashed over me, salt water stinging my eyes. I fought my way to the surface and squinted towards the light, trying to work out which direction I should be headed. I looped the cutters round my wrist and then, as another wave hit me, began to swim. She can have only been 30 or 40 feet away, but that swim was the most arduous I have ever undertaken. The waves and current pulled me away from her, and the sound of her cries kept disappearing as my head was swamped by the swell. I took a breath when I could, stuck my head down, and ploughed towards where I thought she was, hearing the cries of the men behind me, Hannah's own cries growing gradually louder. There was no time to be afraid. I became a thing, hauling each arm in turn out of the dragging water, riding each oncoming wave, telling myself that with each stroke I was, against visible evidence, getting closer to the little boat. I was about 10 feet away when I saw that she was wearing a life jacket, for which I thanked God.
"Hannah!"
I yelled as she hung over the side towards me.
"You'll have to swim!"
And then I saw it. As the beam of the men's boat swung round, stronger, perhaps closer than it had been before, the swell lifted the net wrapped round Hannah's rudder, and suddenly, illuminated in the dark water, I saw something I shall never forget. Caught up in the fine filaments of the tangled net, visible only for the briefest moment, the bodies of fish, seabirds, pieces of creatures that might have died weeks previously, all suspended in the near-invisible web, the floating wall of death. I saw, in that instant, a baby turtle, a huge gull, an albatross perhaps, its feathers half torn away, and worse, near the surface, a dolphin, its eye open, its body bound tight in netting. I am no expert when it comes to sea creatures, but I knew it was alive. And Hannah, hanging over the edge, had seen it too. I heard her piercing scream, and then, as I reached for the side of the boat, I saw in her huge eyes the reflected horror of what I, too, had seen. I reached up a hand, praying with a shudder that my limbs were not going to come into contact with the rotting bodies below.
"Hannah!" I yelled. "You've got to swim! Come on!"
The light swung away from us, then back again. For a millisecond I saw her face, still fixed on the water, drained of colour. She was sobbing hard, lost to me, paralysed by what she now knew to be beneath her.
"Hannah!"
I pleaded. I couldn't climb up to her. My limbs were too cold, and there was nothing for me to hang on to.
"Hannah!"
I drew up my leg involuntarily as I felt it bump against something. Then, over the rain, my yelling and Millie barking behind us, I caught her wail of despair.
"Brolly!"
It was, I hope, the closest I will ever come to a vision of hell. Hannah's hand reached towards me, and as I turned,
Perhaps 50 feet of that ghost net was illuminated again with its grisly, helpless haul. I thought with a chill of its sheer length, of the number of creatures dying silently below, of the whale chasers and crew trying to cut the living away.
"You've got to get her out!" Hannah was screaming. "You've got to!"
"Hannah, we've got to get to the boat!" I shouted.
But she was near hysterical.
"Cut her free! Please, Mike, cut her free!"
There wasn't any time to debate. I took a deep breath, and when the light swung round again, I grasped the cutters and ducked under the water. The most surprising thing was the silence. After the noise and wind and rain and Hannah's screaming, I felt a strange relief at being away from all the chaos. Then the looming shape of the trapped dolphin swayed into view, and I lunged for it, realizing as I did so how easily my own limbs might be trapped in that net, how easily I might be dragged down. I swung at the net with the cutters, trying to keep a purchase as the surprising weight of the ghost net pulled it away. I cut, and as I wrestled with the net, I felt the nylon filaments give. The dolphin twisted, perhaps frightened out of its deathly torpor by this new threat. As the light dipped and swooped upon us, I saw that the animal was bleeding, that its dorsal fin had been almost sliced away, that its skin was cut where it had fought against the fibres. I had to keep closing my eyes as the corpses of the dead kept rising up to meet me, the net swirling, threatening to make me part of that terrifying haul.
"Mike!"
I heard at a distance Hannah's muffled wail. And then, suddenly, I had cut through the last of the net and the dolphin fled, wavering into the murky dark, heading towards what I hoped was open water. I broke the surface, my mouth a huge, retching O of relief.
"Hannah!"
I shouted, holding up the cutters. Finally, her face white with fear, she slipped over the edge of the boat and into my arms, pressing her face against mine so that she didn't have to see any more of what surrounded us. After she had established that I had cut the dolphin free, she said nothing during the trip back to shore. She asked, her mouth pressed to my ear, if I had seen a baby, and when I said no, she buried her face in Millie's wet neck. I held her close to me as we bucked and dipped back across the waves and tried not to shiver too violently, but the looks I exchanged with the two men told me everything I needed to know about how lucky we had been. Liza was already running towards us when we arrived at the jetty. She was wearing a wetsuit and her eyes were dark with fear. She didn't even see me, so desperate was she to grab her daughter to her.
"I'm sorry, Mum."
Hannah was crying, her frozen, bloodless arms wound tightly round her mother's neck.
"I just wanted to help them." "I know you did, darling. I know. But, Rolly,"
Hannah began to sob violently,
"I saw..."
Liza grabbed the blanket that was held towards her, wrapped her daughter in it, and rocked her gently on her haunches as if she were much younger than 11. A small crowd had gathered, standing on the dark sand, illuminated by car headlights.
"Oh, Hannah,"
she kept saying, and what I heard in her broken voice nearly felled me. "I'm so sorry, Liza," I said, when she finally looked up. I was shaking hard despite the blanket someone had placed round my shoulders. "I was only upstairs 5 minutes, and..." She shook her head mutely, and in the dark I found it impossible to say whether she was excusing me or warning me not to come closer, perhaps shaking her head in disbelief at the unbelievable folly of a man who couldn't keep an eye on an 11-year-old girl for 15 minutes.
"I reckon the little boat's a goner," said someone. "Nets are all wrapped round her rudder. I wouldn't be surprised if she goes down."
"I don't care about the boat."
Liza's face was pressed to her daughter's. And then, as Hannah cried harder,
"It's okay, baby. You're safe now."
It was hard to tell whether she was comforting Hannah or herself.
I stared at them, wishing I could envelop them in my arms. I felt again the dragging sensation I had noticed when I was pulling against the net, as I grasped that I had sabotaged my last chance with Liza and what my lack of watchfulness had almost cost her. I felt something catch in my chest and drop my head. Then someone shouted that one of the larger boats was caught in the net and several people headed back down the beach towards the jetty. A woman I didn't know handed me a mug of sweet tea. It scalded my mouth, but I didn't care. Then Kathleen appeared behind me.
"We'd better get you back," she said,
laying a gnarled hand on my shoulder. Suddenly Greg was running towards us through the dark. "Liza?" he was shouting. "Liza?" His voice was full of fear. "I just heard. Is Hannah okay?" There was something proprietorial in that fear, and for once I felt sympathetic rather than indignant. "I'm sorry," I said again, into the blackness, hoping Liza would hear me. Then, flanked by people I didn't know, I turned and walked slowly up the path towards the hotel. It was almost 1 in the morning before I began to feel warm again. Kathleen had forbidden me the steaming bath I craved, but had plied me with hot tea until I had to plead with her to stop. She had built up the fire in my room, in the fireplace I had assumed was merely decorative, and as I shivered under several duvets, she brought up a concoction of her own, which included hot lemon, honey, something spicy, and an equal measure of brandy. "You can't take any chances," she said, tucking me in as if I were a child. "You'd be surprised at what being in seas like that can do to you." "How's Hannah?" I asked, as having placed another log on the fire, she made to leave the room. "Sleeping," she said, brushing non-existent dust from her trousers. "Little mite's exhausted, but she's okay. She got the same treatment you did, bar the brandy." She was pretty shocked by what she saw. Kathleen's face was briefly grim. "Not a sight I'd wish on anyone," she said. "But we did what we could. They freed a whale, you know, by the Hillman place, and they're still going. What that net would have taken if the boys hadn't spotted it." I saw again that murky water, those floating bodies, and tried, as I had for the past hours, to push it all away. I wondered whether Liza was still out there, launching herself into those wild seas to destroy the nets. "Kathleen," I said quietly, "I'm so sorry." But she cut me off. "You need rest," she said firmly. "Really? Burrow down and get some sleep." And finally, weary to my bones, I obeyed. When I heard the noise, I could not be sure whether I had been asleep for hours or minutes. Years of London living had made me alert to any unexpected nocturnal sound, and I propped myself on an elbow in my bed, blinking into the dark, still spinning in the strange space between dreams and reality. For a moment I couldn't remember where I was, and then the dying red embers of the fire reminded me. I sat upright, the layers of bedclothes dropping from me, my eyes adjusting to the dark. Someone was standing by my bed. "What?" Liza McCullen leaned forward and placed a finger on my lips. "Don't say anything," she murmured. I wondered briefly whether I was still dreaming. I could hardly make out her silhouette in the blackened room, but my dreams had been fitful and horrifying, full of choking water and the bodies of the lost. Here in the warm darkness, I could smell the sea on her, feel the faint grittiness of the salt on her skin as her hand met mine. And then, as she moved closer, I could feel her breath, the shocking, numbing softness of her lips on mine. "Liza," I said, but could not be sure whether her name was flooding my thoughts or I had spoken it aloud. "Liza." She slid wordlessly into the bed beside me, her limbs still chilled and damp from the night air. Her fingers traced my face, rested briefly on the bruises wrought by Greg, then wound themselves into my hair. She kissed me with a ferocity that incapacitated me. I felt her delicate weight on me, the sudden cool of her skin against mine as she pulled her shirt over her head, heard the distant crackle of flames. Then, my thoughts jumbling, I stopped her. I took her face in my hands, trying to see her, trying to gauge what storm I was entering now. "Lisa," I said, "I don't understand." She paused above me. I could sense, rather than see, that she was looking at me. "Thank you," she whispered. "Thank you for bringing my daughter back to me." She was electric. It was as if every fibre of her pulsed with energy, as if she was some force of nature undammed, a genie let out of a bottle. For weeks I had imagined this, had thought of myself making tender love to this sad girl, kissing away her melancholy. But here, wrapped around me, was someone I had not anticipated. She was greedy, encompassing, alive. Her body was as lithe as that of an eel, and she moved against me as relentlessly as waves. The ease with which she gave herself up to me was humbling. "Is this a thank you?" I wanted to ask in my few remaining moments of lucidity. A reaction to the shock of the evening? Somewhere deep in the recesses of my memory, I recalled Kathleen's words, that Lisa took the death of sea creatures hard. And then, twice a year, that poor fool thinks he's got a chance. I made to speak, and then, as Liza's lips melted into me, as her skin warmed and then burnt fiercely against mine, and I finally felt heat grow within me, I was incapable of speech, or of thinking anything at all. When I woke, the bed was empty. Even before I was awake enough to think with any clarity, I realized I had known that would be the case. I blinked hard in the dawn light, allowing the events of the previous night to seep slowly into me. She had let me in. I had looked into those iridescent eyes, and I had seen into her soul. And when she had let me in, she had allowed me to be the man I had always wanted to be with her, the man I had waited all my life to become. Strong, certain, filled with passion, not some pale imitation of love. Someone who could protect her, cherish her, bring her joy through sheer force of will. I felt as if I had aged 20 years. I felt like a boy. I felt I could demolish buildings with my bare hands. As my eyes adjusted to the light, and I pushed myself upright, I was unsure whether to feel elation at what I had been given, or melancholy that it had already been taken from me. I had been so sure that I would wake alone that it was several minutes before I saw that I was not the only person in the room. Lisa was sitting in the leather chair, which she had pulled towards the window. She was in her jeans, and her knees were pulled up to her chin, her arms wrapped round them. I glanced at my watch. It was 5:15. I gazed at her, wanting to watch her forever, knowing that when she guessed I was awake, I would have to hide that fact. I felt an unexpected pang of empathy with Greg. I, too, knew now what it was like to love someone unreachable. "Good morning," I said quietly. "Please don't pull back too far," I told her silently. "Please don't make it obvious that you regret this." She turned slowly. Her eyes met mine, and I observed that wherever her thoughts were, they were far from me. How could that be, I wondered, when I felt as if her body was etched on my own, that her blood now ran through my veins? "Mike," she said, You say you know about publicity. I stumbled mentally, trying to keep up.
Uh-huh, I said.
What if someone who had done something really bad owned up to it? Something nobody had known about. That would generate publicity, wouldn't it? I ran a hand through my hair. Sorry, I began. I don't follow. I'll tell you how Letty died, she said, her voice soft but as clear as a bell. And you can tell me who that will save.
19. Liza. Nitrazepam. Mogadon by its commercial name. 42 pills in a bottle. Pills to help me sleep. Perfectly legitimate, perfectly understandable, given my history of postnatal depression and the stresses of bringing up a young family. The doctor had been happy to give them to me. In fact, he had paid little attention, so gratified was he to be confronted by someone to whose problems there was a simple solution. He had known me for some time, had seen me through a pregnancy. He knew my mother-in-law, the baby's father, where I came from. I need to get some proper sleep, I said. Just for a little while. I know I'll be able to cope better. He had handed me the prescription without a moment's hesitation, then turned back to his screen to prepare himself for his next patient. Moments later, I stood in the car park of the pharmacy, gazing at the label on the bottle in my hand, gazing at the warnings it contained. Sleeping pills. Takers of life in the wrong circumstances. When I held them, I felt a strange, hollow excitement. They would give me back my life. When I began my life in Australia, my real life, rather than the period in which I had merely existed, Kathleen persuaded me to see her doctor and ask for something to help me sleep. I was still plagued with nightmares, to the extent that sometimes I was afraid to lay my head on the pillow. In sleep, I would see Letty's terrified face, hear her screaming my name, and I prayed for oblivion. The first remedy the Australian doctor offered was those pills, albeit under a different name. When I registered what they were on the prescription he offered me, I took a faltering step towards him and passed out cold. I was told by people who knew no better that I came from a broken home, but it never felt broken to me. I never felt the lack of a father. My mother was enough parent for anyone, blessed with an indomitable spirit, fierce with maternal love and pride, determined that I should escape her own mistakes with a decent education. She shepherded and chivied me, scolded and adored me, and even though we were patently neither a rich nor a conventional family, I never felt the lack of anything. Even by childhood standards, I sensed that my lot was a good one. My mother worked incessantly, low-paid part-time work that kept me close by her. Often she worked as I slept, and now I wonder how she managed to raise a smile and a cooked meal for me at breakfast. We lived in a cottage in an area that was half suburban sprawl, half village, a little way out of London, rented to Mum by a woman she had once worked for. I had 20-odd friends within half a mile of my house, and the freedom within that half mile to do pretty well what I wanted. Twice during my childhood, we flew to Australia, which made me an expert among my peers on global matters. One day, Mum promised me, we'd go and live there with Aunt Kathleen. But I don't think she wanted to be close to my grandparents. She never had much good to say about them. And when my grandfather died, she found other reasons. Her latest job, my schooling, a man she had grown fond of, not to uproot and move to the other side of the world. And then it was too late. My mum's cancer was shockingly efficient. She had lost weight, a source of pride, then concern when she discovered it was not due solely to her careful monitoring of calories. The latest nice man, a divorcee who lived an hour away by train, found excuses not to visit, and then, as the treatment became messy and unpleasant, as her emotional demands grew greater, melted away. Perhaps stung by his disappearance, independent to the last, she did not tell Kathleen she was dying. I found out afterwards she had sent a letter that would arrive after her death. In it, she told Kathleen I was not to be pressured to go to Australia, but asked her to be there for me wherever I wanted to be. It was the one badly judged decision of her maternal career. There is never a good age at which to lose your mother, but my 17-year-old self was spectacularly ill-prepared to face life alone. I watched my proud, glamorous mother shrink, then diminish. I saw her appetite for life disappear, buried in morphine and confusion. At first, I did my best to care for her, and then, as the nurses took over, and I understood what she had not been brave enough to tell me, I withdrew. I told myself it was not happening, and as my mother's friends whispered behind their hands at how brave, how capable I was, I sat at home alone, stared at the pitiless bills, and wished I had a life that belonged to anyone but myself. My mother died one dark, painful night in November. I was with her, and told her she should stop apologizing, that I would be fine, that I knew I was loved. "There's money in my blue bag," she told me hoarsely, in one of her last moments of lucidity. "Use it to go to Kathleen. She'll look after you." But when I looked, there was less than £100, not enough to get me to Scotland, let alone Australia. I suspect pride kept me from telling Kathleen of my plight. Perhaps predictably, I went off the rails. I left school and got a job stacking shelves, then discovered that this would not keep me in my mother's house. The rent arrears built up, until my mother's friend told me apologetically that she could not afford for me to stay. She offered me a position as a live-in nanny, and was relieved when I told her I was going to stay with a friend. My life became chaotic. I sold bits of my mother's jewellery, although what little she'd had was worth barely enough to keep me in food. I lived in a squat, discovered nightclubs, and worked as a barmaid, trying to ensure that I was drunk enough when I left each night, that I didn't have to think about how lonely I was when I got home. For a while I was a goth, and when I was 21, I got pregnant by one of the many men who passed through that squat in Victoria. A giant of a man whose last name I never knew, but who made a great lentil stew, stroked my hair, and called me baby on one of the nights when I had enough money to get very, very drunk. Once I realized I was pregnant, everything changed. I don't know if it was hormones or just the inheritance of my mother's good sense, but a self-preservation instinct took over. I thought of what I had avoided thinking about for 4 years, and what my mother would have said if she could see where I was. I never considered getting rid of the baby. I was glad that I would have a family of my own once again, someone who was linked to me by blood. So, I stripped my hair of its violent dyes, got a job working as a mother's help, and when Hannah was born, I was employed by friends of that family in a picture framing shop. They were happy for me to work until 1:30, when I had to pick up Hannah from nursery. I wrote to Kathleen occasionally and sent her photographs, and she always wrote back promptly, enclosing a few pounds to buy something for the baby, telling me she was proud of me for the life I had created for myself. It was not an easy life, or a financially stable one, but it was fairly happy. I think, as Kathleen used to tell me, my mother would have been pleased to see it. Then one day Stephen Villiers came in and asked for a moulded gilt frame with a dark green mount for a print he had bought, and my life, as I had created it, changed forever. I was lonely, you see. I was lucky, I knew, to have a family who were prepared to tolerate me and a baby, but I used to watch them around the kitchen table, joking with each other in front of the television, the children's feet prodding their benign, grubby-jumpered father. I even envied their arguments. I would have loved someone to argue with. As I watched Hannah turn from a mewing, downy kitten into a beaming, affectionate toddler, I wanted the same for her. I wanted her to have a father who would love her and swing her round by her hands in a garden, carry her on his shoulders and complain good-humouredly about her nappies. I wanted to have someone I could talk to about her, someone who might have an opinion on whether I was feeding her the right things for her age, who might think about schools or shoes. I had soon found that men were not interested in women with babies, the men I knew anyway. They were not interested in why you couldn't meet them at the pub in the evening, why you suggested the park at Sunday lunchtime. They didn't see the charms of my beautiful fair-haired girl, just the restrictions she imposed on me. So when Stephen Villiers bumped into me outside the supermarket, and not only did not eye Hannah like she was something infectious, but offered to push the buggy for me so that I could manage my shopping more easily on the short walk home, was it really any surprise that I was lost? He reminded me at first of the father of the family I lived with. He had the same shabby, expensive way of dressing. But that was the only similarity. Stephen was compact, but gave the impression of height. He had a kind of inbuilt authority, one of those people who make you stand back slightly without quite understanding why. He was surprisingly old never to have married, a fact he put down, while looking me straight in the eye, to never having met the right person. He lived with his mother in a beautiful house at Virginia Water, the sort you see in expensive property magazines, with huge, neatly clipped hedges and a bathroom for every bedroom. He was surprised when I expressed awe at what he possessed. He was the kind of man who assumed his life was the norm and never bothered to inquire further. Given his background, his assets, I was unsure for a long time what he saw in me. I wore clothes from charity shops. I was no longer wild-looking, but there was no way I could have been confused with the kind of sleek, moneyed girls he had grown up with. I had nothing to offer. When I look at photographs from that period, I now know a little better. I was beautiful. I had a kind of unworldliness, despite my situation, that men found appealing. I was without friends or support, and therefore malleable. I was still emotionally giddy from my daughter's birth, anxious to see love everywhere, to bestow what I felt for her on everyone around me. I thought he was a saviour, and everything I said and did would have convinced him of that. It was probably how he saw himself then. The first time I went to bed with him, I lay in his arms afterwards, and I told him of my life, of the mistakes I had made, while he held me close, kissed the top of my head, and told me I was safe. There is something remarkably seductive, if you have been alone and vulnerable, in hearing you are safe. He said he was meant to be with me, that he thought I was his mission. I was so grateful, so besotted, that I saw nothing worrying in that statement. 6 weeks after we met, he asked me to marry him. I moved in with him and his mother. My clothes became more conventional. He took me shopping. And my hair was tidier, which was more fitting in the fiancé of that kind of man. I took a new pride in my housekeeping skills, slowly adapting under the terse tutelage of my prospective mother-in-law. There were hiccups, but Hannah and I learned together how to live under that roof. I had grown up, I told myself. I enjoyed the challenge of fitting in. Then, some 4 months later, I discovered I was pregnant. Initially, Stephen was shocked, but quite quickly delighted. Letty was born, as it grew light, on the morning of the 16th of April, and I thanked God, as Hannah and Stephen cooed over her, that I finally had a family of my own, a proper family. Letty was not the most beautiful of babies. In fact, she resembled a Shar-Pei for several months longer than she should have. But she was the most adored. I used to watch Stephen's uncomplicated love for her, her grandmother's affectionate fussing, and wish it had been the same for Hannah. As a baby, Letty was as sweet-natured and sunny as they come. Perhaps it was sleep deprivation, or just the moment-to-moment nature of life with a new baby, but it wasn't until several months after Letty's birth that I realized Stephen hardly noticed Hannah. Until then, I had told myself he loved her, that his occasional thoughtlessness towards her was a male thing, rather than deliberate omission. I had little to go on, you see. Having been brought up by my mother and seen so little of my grandfather, I wasn't familiar with the ways of men. Stephen was a good provider, as his mother was always telling me. He knew about discipline and routines. And if Hannah frustrated him with her 2-year-old tantrums and her faddiness about food, was it any surprise that he sent her to bed? Letty was so adorable. Was it any surprise that, fairly often, Hannah's own behaviour was seen as wanting? I tell myself now that I was blinded by the demands of new motherhood, that one sees what one wants to see. But in my heart I should have known. I should have grasped earlier that my daughter's increasing silence was not solely the result of adapting to a new sibling. I should have seen that my mother-in-law and Stephen had become harsher with her, their criticisms more openly expressed. Mostly, I should have guessed it from that woman's attitude. She never forgave me for saddling her son, her senior manager with prospects, with a child who wasn't his. She didn't like the fact that I had no history, as she called it. Oh, she was polite enough to start with, but she was one of those bridge-playing women, the ones with blue helmet hair and Jaeger cardigans, and everything I was screamed irresponsibility and fecklessness at her, whether I was making a lentil stew, hippie food, or letting Hannah sleep with me when she was 2. She dared not say anything at first, when Stephen and I were locked in our bubble of new love. She had led him to believe that he was the head of the family since his own father had died, and now found that she had painted herself into a corner, because he would not discuss my supposed faults. Until Letty was born, when I could not meet their standards. Then my inability to cope with 2 small children in the manner Stephen and she expected was gradually revealed. As the toys spread across the floors and our beds remained unmade until the afternoon, my clothes wore epaulettes of baby milk, and Hannah screamed in a corner over some supposed misdemeanour, my mother-in-law discovered she could say and do whatever she liked. Once, before it got too bad, I dared to ask Stephen whether we might find somewhere of our own, whether we might be happier by ourselves. But the look he gave me was withering. "You can barely get those girls dressed by yourself," he said, "let alone run a house. Do you think you'd last 5 minutes without my mother?" Looking back now, I find it hard to identify myself as that creature. In Kathleen's pictures, from which Stephen was long removed, I see a strange, lost girl, with hair that wasn't like hers, and weird, docile clothes. Her eyes display a fearful determination not to recognize what she had got herself into. What was the alternative, after all? I had nothing. No home, no money, no support. I had 2 infant daughters and a man who was a father to them, prepared to forgive me for the mess I had made of my life. I had a mother-in-law who was prepared to tolerate me in her beautiful house, even though it was far beyond anything I had known. My domestic skills weren't up to much, and frankly, my manners often let them down, especially since Stephen had been elected to the local council, and his career at the bank was taking off. You don't understand how easy it is to be ground down if you haven't been there. With his mother's help, over the years, Stephen gradually grew to acknowledge my faults. Our wedding was spoken of rarely, then never. Hannah learnt to close her mouth while she ate, and that the better she behaved, the less likely she was to be scolded. I learnt that if you wore long sleeves, the mothers at playgroup would stop remarking on your bruises. I had grown up believing that that kind of thing only happened in the most desperate houses. I thought it was about poverty and lack of education. With Stephen, I learnt that it was about my own inadequacy, my failure to repay the trust he had placed in me, my inability to make myself look halfway decent, and, when it was really bad, my uselessness in bed. The first time he hurt me, I was so shocked, I assumed it had been an accident. We were upstairs and the girls were crying, fighting over some cheap plastic toy. I had been so distracted by them that I had forgotten the iron, which was burning through his shirt. He had come into the room, furious at the noise, yelled at the girls, and then, when he saw the shirt, he cuffed me, as if I were a dog. "Oh!" I exclaimed. "That hurt!" He turned to me with an expression of disbelief on his face, as if I hadn't understood it was meant to. And as I stood, holding my throbbing ear, he walked briskly downstairs as if nothing had happened. He apologized later, blamed work stress or something like it. But sometimes I think that that first time was a tipping point for him, that once he had crossed the line, it was easier to cross it again. Sometimes we went months with nothing happening, but there were times when almost anything I did, peeling potatoes wastefully, not polishing shoes, prompted a fist or a hard hand, never a fight. He was too clever for that. Just enough to tell me who was boss. By the time I realized what I had to do, I was a shadowy creature, a woman who had learned it was best not to offer an opinion, answer back, or draw attention to myself, that scars fade quickly, even if their memory lingers. But then I looked at my daughter's face on the day he hit her hard for failing to take her shoes off before she reached the pale green hall carpet, and my resolve began to return. I began to stash money. I would ask for an amount to buy a coat for Letty, knowing he could refuse his daughter nothing, then would show off something immaculate I had bought from the charity shop, pocketing the difference. I squirreled away money from the supermarket shopping. I was good at living on little, having done it for years, and they suspected nothing, because I had become such a downtrodden thing. By then, I hated him. The fog of my depression lifted, and I saw clearly what had happened to me. I saw his coldness, his arrogance, his blind ambition. I saw his determination to ensure my elder daughter knew she was a second-class citizen in his house, even at the tender age of 6. I saw that other families did not live like we did, and finally, that his class, his background and financial position did not prevent what he was doing from being abuse. I saw, with relief, that my daughters loved each other regardless, that their tenderness, games and bickering were those of every other set of siblings. I saw Letty's plump brown arms linked casually round her sister's neck, heard her high, lisping voice telling Hannah stories about what she had done at play school, begging her to pretty up her hair. I saw Hannah at night, snuggled in with Letty as she read her a story, their blonde hair entwined, their nighties a pastel tangle. He had not poisoned them yet. But seeing the truth of my situation did not help me. I could leave with Hannah, I thought, and they would barely care. Half the time he told me I was a waste of space anyway. But they would never hand over Letty. In one argument, when I had threatened to leave with them both, he had laughed at me. "What kind of judge is going to let you look after my daughter?" he said. "Look at what you have to offer, Elizabeth. Look at your history, squats, and goodness knows what, your lack of education or prospects, and then look at what she'll get with me. You wouldn't have a bloody hope." I suspect he was sleeping with someone else by then. His physical demands on me were far fewer, a source of relief. He had a schizophrenic attitude towards me. If I dressed nicely, he told me I was ugly. if I approached him with affection, that I was a turn-off. If another man looked at me, even if I was dressed simply in jeans and a loose shirt, he held my face tightly between his hands and told me that no other man would ever lay a hand on me. On the night when his work colleague made an admiring comment about my legs, he forced himself on me so that I could barely walk the next day. What kept me going was the money mounting up in the lining of my green coat, the hours in which they thought I spent mindlessly ironing or washing up or sitting with the girls in the park, but in which I sat, the peaceful expression on my face belying my burning intent, plotting escape. They were creatures of habit. Every Tuesday and Thursday she would play bridge. For years, on Thursday and Friday evenings, he went to his club, a euphemism for the other woman, and on Saturdays he played golf. I cherished those Thursday evenings, when I knew I had a few precious hours alone with the girls, to laugh, run around, be silly, and remember who I was, before the sound of a key in the door could leave me silent and cowed. Then, one Thursday, Stephen came back early and found the letter I was writing to Kathleen, telling her the truth about what he had done to me. After his initial rage was spent, I suspect he told his mother I was not to be left alone. After that, whenever I was in the house, so was one of them. And whenever I went out, they would find a reason to take Letty to the park or keep her at home. From that point, I was never alone with my two girls. I think he knew by then he was losing control. That letter to Kathleen, thank goodness I hadn't addressed it, had shocked him, not only because it showed I might have the courage to tell someone what he had done, but because it laid his actions bare in print, and they were not pretty. Until then, I think he had convinced himself that his behaviour was reasonable, that his beatings were an inevitable consequence of my failures. To see the cruel words, the split lips and broken fingers in print, to see his actions for what they were, the behaviour of a bully, must have been unconscionable for him. I bided my time. I had become patient. I just needed to get to Kathleen. I could work out everything else from there. Her home was a mirage I hugged to myself on the nights when the darkness of my life was overwhelming. He knew only that I had a distant aunt. He had no idea where she lived. By the time I had worked out a plan and a date for its execution, I was so nervous that I was surprised they couldn't see it. I hadn't been able to eat properly.